Please introduce yourself. I'd like people to meet you.
For sure. My name is Moise Bouani. I'm a Chicago Public School teacher. I am also a member of the Chicago Teachers Union. I'm Pakistani. I moved to the United States at the age of 3 to our wonderful neighborhood of West Ridge. I've lived here for the vast majority of my life and have been involved in different organizing spaces, from immigration justice to disability justice, and now work as an educator that specifically tackles inequities in education and also the unhoused community in our neighborhoods, whether that's the 65,000 overall or the 20,000 plus young people that are Chicago Public School students.
Say why you're involved in the campaign for the alderman of the 50th Ward.
Yeah, for me, this race is really a race that tries to capture the pulse of all the community organizers and neighbors and refugees and immigrants and people who've lived here for a very long time but have never felt this neighborhood live up to its potential and promise to working people and to people who are, you know, new to this neighborhood. So for me, this race is really embedded in making sure that we as a neighborhood, that we as a city continue to fight to protect those that are hyper-marginalized while also making the right steps in our city and with our policies and with our finances to make sure that this continues to be a city that welcomes people versus isolate them and run them away. So
what is that potential?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this neighborhood and growing up in this area. I feel much of my existence and all that I've become in life connects to the investment people put in me. And those were public school teachers. Those were people who worked at the parks, people who worked in our libraries. And just, you know, growing up here, being part of the Pakistani community and being part of the South Asian community, I recognized early on whatever struggles we had, whether that was with housing or food instability, it was a community that always came through. This is a neighborhood, like many of the neighborhoods in Chicago, where we're left to the politics of chance. But when we look at our neighbors and we go into our communities and talk to them, people actually care about each other. They care about compassionate policies that don't leave people unhoused. They care about fully funded schools. They care about treatment, not trauma. They care about mental health clinics. They care about being involved in their community as well. And that's the potential of this neighborhood versus, you know, this isolation that we all felt during the pandemic, this isolation that kind of continues or has continued for 42 years, whether it's Bernard Stone or Deborah Silverstein. People here want to get along and they want a neighborhood that champions the common good.
The difference that you might make as opposed to what Deborah Silverstein has done over the 12 years.
You know, I think it's the small things and then it's the bigger stuff. At a small level, I think so much about, you know, when we get out in the streets or when I work with neighbors or what I've worked with neighbors throughout the pandemic and even before then, many of the issues that they bring up whenever the city has a program or whenever the neighborhood has a program is that no one is translating documents. No one is doing outreach to all the 40 plus languages that are present here. No one is plugging them in on services that are offered by the city. And then it gets deeper when you think about all of the charity and 501c3s that exist in our neighborhood that they don't feel that they have an active partner in the aldermanic office. And then it gets deeper and deeper when we think about, you know, when Trump was president, we had issues in this community along with other communities in Chicago where ICE was trying to make their raids, but people did not know or didn't understand what supports and how Chicago is a welcoming city and how Chicago in our schools, which are sanctuary schools, how they were protected and they were safe. People had no clue. And this gets deeper to thinking about shutting down the mental health centers, the public mental health centers 12 years ago, and how many people made access to those in this neighborhood. This gets deeper into thinking about a school like Clinton Elementary, where 40 plus languages are spoken, getting $360,000 cut from their budget. Thinking about ward democracy, that we don't get to make decisions as a community on the $1.5 million a year that we get, or the zoning that happens in this neighborhood when it comes to zoning impacting our pedestrians, our infrastructure protecting our young people, to zoning impacting our neighbors and whoever moves in and how their property taxes are impacted and the businesses that are shuttered in this area. All of these things at a individual level are small, but when you bring them all together, they become a bigger part of the issue in this neighborhood. So when I think about our campaign, one, our campaign champions war democracy. It wants more say. It wants people to see this neighborhood as a mirror that where they're reflected back in. Our campaign champions participatory budgeting. Our campaign champions language access. Our campaign champions affordable housing. This is a neighborhood where so many people are in precarious situations or living doubled up. When you go into apartment buildings, you see 10 to 12 names. However, we only have 12 affordable housing units. How is that okay? This is a neighborhood where our schools will tell you the stories of people just not having housing instability, people moving away, being at a school, then another school, then another school, or populations in the school dropping because people can't afford to live here. So how can we only have 12 units of housing? This is a neighborhood that also firmly believes in public safety, and public safety and funding public safety looks like having a litany of resources that are, do not relate to violence, that do not relate to just policing, but they relate to opening up the mental health clinics. They relate to having our young people have options and programs. They relate to transitionary programs for our elders. They relate to lighting. They relate to small investments which make people feel that this neighborhood cares for them.
The Empowering Communities for Public Safety Ordinance is an attempt to end the impunity that had been historic in this town. The last 12 years now, almost $1.5 billion in judgments had been paid out if you add the interest on the borrowed money. Can you speak to that and what your approach is to that form of policing, although you touched on it, but maybe you could go deeper. Deborah Silverstein has not tried to educate the community about this historic change?
Yeah, you know, originally we were supporters, and when I say we, I mean myself and my and our community chapter, the United Working Families of the 50th Ward, of CPAC, which was supposed to be kind of what ECPS is now, but CPAC merged with the other ordinance, which is called GAPA, and it's come to this point where it's called ECPS now. The reason we were supportive of this is exactly what you highlighted. This is a city where, you know, we're missing crucial services. They've either been privatized or eliminated, whether, you know, that's a robust office of gun violence protection, whether that's considering the Department of the Environment, whether it's our mental health clinics, all these things. And much of that also kind of is embarrassing when you think about how much we pay out in police settlements. So the purpose of the council, the purpose of ECPS is, one, to create more transparency around policing. It is to create community councils in the districts that exist. It is to kind of bring the community in relationship with what is happening with policing in the neighborhood. And it is to kind of cut down and ultimately eliminate the type of money we end up spending on police settlements and the type of people that are roaming our streets that might not be considered safe in terms of their complaints and their history as police officers. And also is to build this greater connection of democracy to, you know, a big municipal force such as policing. I'm not sure absolutely why our alderwoman hasn't talked this up. I know that, you know, the timing before the vote, we had to organize in front of her office and bring this issue to her matter because she hadn't looked at any of this material. She admitted to us, and then ultimately she did vote with us. But, you know, a program like this, along with the elected representative school board that's coming around the corner, those are just, you know, those are symptoms of a good democracy when you have programs like this, when you have people involved, when you have people understanding, when you have advocates who are running for the council, who are going to be people who are going to hold some level of police oversight and accountability to the communities, to this community and other communities. I think to me that's a slam dunk in any which way. I've never been opposed to oversight. I've never been opposed to community and ward democracy. So a program like this for any politician should be one that should be supported, unless you're saying that, you know, we don't want oversight on, you know, in a concerned area of, you know, where the police, for example, have paid out $1.5 billion in settlements over the last decade plus. I don't think we as a city can afford to pay this out, especially when people are struggling and need more and more lifelines as we're fighting for their city to invest more in social services and people rather than the idea of corporate welfare or just these police payouts. I think, you know, during the pandemic, you know, I talk about this a lot, but I'm really deeply concerned about the overall approach of our government sometimes of creating a you know a government and a society of chance, right? Meaning leave people to their chances. You don't necessarily sentence people to, you know, the horrors of housing and food injustice or instability, but you just say, you know, well, we don't have answers. You know, myself and a couple of teachers at Roberto Clemente, we felt this just intense amount of tinge of fear during the pandemic. And, you know, everybody felt some level of pain or fear, but, you know, ours extended to our students because we knew how much that school continues to be a lifeline for many of our young people in that neighborhood. Whether it's, you know, the guarantee of two meals, potentially three meals a day that are, you know, breakfast, lunch, and some of the dinner meals that are wonderful, the wonderful staff and Aramark members at Clemente would put together to people, or whether the fact that many of our students were unhoused and really took advantage of the programs we had for our unhoused students to help with laundry, all the way with giving somebody 8, 10, 12 hours a day of a secure, safe place where they could learn or just be themselves. So during the pandemic, we went out, we you know, turned to every single person we knew, from family, from friends, from local businesses, to charities, to mutual aid programs, and we started doing whatever we could to support students. In the end of our program called the Clemente Solidarity Fund, we had raised $50,000 for our students, and we were paying out for rent, for hygiene needs, for child needs, for baby formula, for diaper, anything we could. We kept a list of every single person we gave to. We spoke to parents. We spoke with grandparents. We did check-ins. We made sure we fought against any landlords who were trying to evict families during this period. Our young people were involved, and they were doing a lot of the intake work. So they were talking to students, especially students who were nervous about talking about their life situation and their struggle, because it is something hard to open up about. So our young people were really the driving force behind this, and we made sure in every single way we could acquire whatever we could to support people. Sometimes we had to give people rides to interviews. You know, that was the nature of everything we did. Our young people also opened up two pantries in the area. One was at Clemente, one was a couple of blocks away, and we were doing distributions every Wednesday and Sunday. We were stocking whenever we could. Whenever we had money, we were giving out PPE. We were also creating, you know, we were also fighting vaccine hesitance and any type of misinformation people were given. So we were going full scale, myself, a few teachers, and our young folks together. And the idea of home, you know, it is very hard for me as a human being because, you know, obviously my family's been around as long as other families have. But, you know, all I know about, you know, what being a Bolani is really the story of my father. I didn't get a chance to meet my grandparents. I didn't get a chance to know a majority of my cousins because of, you know, just the historical things that have happened in South Asia. Some of them we've never met after the partition. You know, when I go back home, there really isn't, you know, for example, my mom's side, there really isn't much family left. Many have passed away because of the difficulty of life for them and the neighborhoods they were in. So home has always been a tough subject because I don't know necessarily where home is. And that's why I fight really hard for Westridge, because this is home. This is all I have. You know, if I get a chance to talk to my kids someday about, you know, what home is, I can't say much about Pakistan, but I can say much about this area, and I can say much about all the amazing people here. It also gets deeper when I think about, you know, my history with, you know, people being Islamophobic towards us or xenophobic towards us, especially after 9/11. That's really rooted me as a young person, and now at 35, about how much we need to fight for people to feel home. Right. No one should be afraid of anywhere. No one should feel unwelcome in home. No one should feel unsafe. Whether that comes against the horrors of anti-Semitism, of anti-Asian behavior, racism, you know, xenophobia, Islamophobia, all those things, or it's just the fact that people want safe communities, fully funded schools, fully resourced communities. They want their neighbors to be able to live comfortably at home. They want young people to reach their aspirations, and they want elders to retire with dignity. That's every single thing that, you know, defines our fight for home.
Louise Barani, thank you for taking the time, and I hope to speak to you again about what's actually going on in this 50th ward that we could improve on, that you could improve on with your staff to make it a functioning home. A lot of people live in dysfunctional homes, and I would say that many of the wards in this city have been dysfunctional under the politics that the ward currently is governed by. Thank you.
Thank you.